This is the House Water Committee on Monday, February 14th. And our discussion item today is a work session, or our agenda today is a work session on House Bill 2025. And before we begin, we have some announcements from our staff. Would you please, Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Materials in front of you, I just want to highlight what is clipped with the mini black clip are emails that we have received from the last hearing on House Bill 2025. Please add them to your file. You may have received them. I'm not sure which ones actually get sent to the members versus which ones come to the committee. So that packet is that testimony. Also, I wanted to highlight the packet. You have a paper clip of three articles: science and technology, fluoride concerns surface once again, and fluoridation in water. These documents were provided by a Dr. Todd Silverstein from Willamette University. He's been interested. He's been watching our work on this. He offered these articles up as just some documentation for the committee. He emailed them to me. He's been in communication with Representative Dalto, and again, he is just a professor of chemistry over at Willamette, so that might be something that, if you folks are so inclined to review, they're there for your information. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sandy. There's a couple of other, if you wish, housekeeping items before we begin. As you're aware, this is a work session, and also as you're aware, in work sessions, it's invited testimony only, and I have been asked by the Oregon Citizens for Safe Water, the Willamette Riverkeepers, and the Sierra Club to make phone calls to or get testimony from a couple of people. Actually, three, I guess. I am respectfully going to reject that request, in part because, at least in some of the cases, we already have written materials from the individuals that you all have had a chance to see, read, and absorb over the couple of weeks that we've been, working on this. And then with that, what we have on the agenda today, since we've had very little discussion about or from this end, is from the proponents of the House Bill 2025. We're going to be inviting three people, actually four people, to come forward today and give us a presentation. At the conclusion of that presentation, we will be reviewing two sets of amendments that have been submitted, and we may interrupt our sequence of things here because one of those amendments is going to comes from the Dr. Representative Gordon Anderson, and when he arrives in the room, we're going to take a little bit out of step and have him maybe introduce the amendment that he has proposed for it. With this, then I think Jane Myers, do you want to introduce the people you have that have come today, or if you would, please?
Yeah, I know I am.
I think we're starting with Dr. Meredith.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Dr. Meredith said he would like to introduce himself.
I'm Michael Meredith. I'm a PhD in biochemistry and nutrition, professor of integrated biosciences at the Oregon Health and Sciences University, the School of Dentistry. Having said that, it's incumbent upon me to relate to you that what I say today is as a private citizen, not a representative of the Oregon Health and Sciences University. Although Dr. Clinton assures me he'll back me to the hilt on about anything I have to say.
Dr. Meredith,
yeah.
Before you begin, Can I interrupt you to have Dr. Anderson, Representative Anderson,
Certainly.
Come up and introduce the amendment and comments that he has on the amendment for us? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Anderson, Gordon Anderson, District 3, and out of breath. Thank you for allowing me to come. I will more than likely just be turning the meat of the amendment over to other representatives from the dental profession, but let me just say that fluoridation has been a long time coming to our state. We are, I believe, close to 20% of our population are covered with fluoride in the water, whereas over 60% are covered throughout the nation. So it behooves us to be looking at this in the way that folks in other legislatures all across the country have done in past years. My personal experience was more with adults, but throughout dental school, throughout my early years of practice, I saw a number of children who did not have the benefit of fluoride, and there is a distinct difference between those who do and those who don't. Children from economic strata that don't allow their getting to a dental office and, of course, don't have fluoride in the water have major problems with dental care. And then we are the ones that are the recipient of the problems that occur in terms of trying to treat those children at much greater cost. It's been stated, I think you may have heard in previous testimony, that $1 placed into prevention through fluorides will avoid approximately $38 of dental care. So it really behooves us to move this issue before the public. When this bill first came to LC and was being talked about in terms of mandate, I had said I personally would have a major problem in moving a mandated bill. Having been a mayor, I don't like the idea of the state asking us to do things and then not coming up with any money. But I think the way the bill has been amended and moved to your committee is a very healthy way. We've been waiting for a long time. And now is the time, I think, to mandate it, but make sure that it's not going to cost the ratepayers, the city, the county, any of the folks that normally would be seeing a financial cost, but rather for the profession, for those interested to seek funds outside the general fund, hopefully some federal funds as time progresses, corporate funds, and I'm sure we're going to see some donations and dedication of funds from the professionals themselves, both the doctors and the hygienists. So I think it's a very good amendment, and I think it's time that we move ahead, take it to the floor, and pass it there and send it to the Senate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative. Are there any questions from Representative Anderson? We'll proceed on then and save you the one getting grilled and beat up on Jane and others later if that's necessary. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your taking the time. I know Representative Anderson has another committee he's headed off to, so we'll appreciate it. And with that, if we could, please again. And sorry for the interruption, Mike, but...
Not a problem.
My purpose in being here today as an enlightened private citizen on this issue is, first of all, to express an opinion, and secondly, to answer questions that you have that have come up in the course of your hearings. Fluoridation is one of those issues that divides the population irrationally. I have very good friends with whom I agree on almost everything except fluoridation. I have acquaintances with whom I agree on nothing except fluoridation. And there's no argument in either way. When I first became involved in this issue when Lake Oswego was considering fluoridating their water supply some years ago, and the way I saw it, I had no particular dog in this fight. My kids were going to get taken care of. My wife is a hygienist. They get good treatment. topical fluoride toothpaste. But then I watched a little bit and I saw that my dog in this fight is the process. What poses for scientific evidence needs much closer scrutiny. And the internet has made it much harder to do this for all of us. Because when you read something in print, you can read about the author. You can trace the history and the origin. The internet is a wonderful thing, but it's also allowed the propagation and dissemination of untruths, non-truths, half-truths, sort of truths, in the guise of truth. At the intersection of science and public policy, there are three quotes, three great truths that were voiced by Americans. One by Mark Twain, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics, with statistics being the most dangerous of the three. As I will demonstrate in a second, you can make anything look any way you want. Statistical analysis is like a magician's cloak. It's meant to cover, it's meant to deceive. It's also meant to serve a purpose on occasion, but improperly applied, knowingly or unknowingly, does not lead to the search for the truth. Secondly, from Ben Franklin, who, although he was paraphrasing Paracelsus, said that dose makes the poison. Of course, his context was the power of the federal government. But the analogy is the same. A small amount of power in a centralized government is a helpful thing, whereas too much is too much. And then thirdly, from that great American deep throat, follow the money. And in this case, if we follow the money, those people who stand to profit most directly, that is the dental profession, have been the loudest and most ardent advocates of fluoridation ever since the Grand Rapids experiment. This is the 60th anniversary of that, I think, actually this month. So it's hard to sort these things out. Referring to the Grand Rapids fluoridation, we have 60 years of what constitutes prospective human epidemiology, which, by the way, is about the only form of human epidemiology that's worth paying much attention to. And as has been done in numerous meta-analysis studies, if you look at the medical records of Grand Rapids, Michigan Water District, compared to a size match non-fluoridated water district, they're identical except for two components. One, Grand Rapids has a lower caries rate, and secondly, it has a lower rate of Alzheimer's disease. Purely accidental in one case and perhaps. But at least in that experimentation, fluoride has been shown to reduce dental caries. The $37 return for every dollar invested in fluoridation is an important figure to consider. I wish that I had brought Dr. Leona Sals with me today, who was a former dean of the University of Kentucky School of Dentistry, and now we're fortunate to have him as a professor of oral surgery at OHSU. And when he first came here, I lived in Kentucky for a while as part of the Public Health Service, and he began talking about the public dental clinic in Harlan County, Kentucky. Well, Harlan County, Kentucky, that's Dukes of Hazzard country. That's Far East coal mining, spit and scratch Appalachia. I asked him sort of jokingly, Leon, are there enough teeth in that county to warrant a public dental clinic? And he looked at me like I had shaken a basic tenet for a second. He says, you know, it's hard to apply for a job at McDonald's when you have no teeth and the first thing they tell you to do is smile. So public dental interest is not a trivial matter. It's something that we should all be in favor of. And the first thing you learn at professor school is you got about 3 minutes before you lose your audience. Much of the evidence you hear anecdotal that you hear presented as opposing the fluoride position is anecdotal, to which I offer my own anecdote. I have two children. Both were gestated, so their pre-eruptive fluoridation occurred, one in a naturally occurring fluoride source, the other an artificial fluoride source. They grew up in the same household with the same sort of dental care, and actually made it all the way through high school, even in Oregon, with no cavities in their head, not one outbreak of caries. One went to college in Iowa City, the University of Iowa, a city with a fluoridated water supply, and that remains caries-free to this day. One went to school at Claremont McKenna and Harvey Mudd in Los Angeles, which is not fluoridated. That one now has several cavities. I think part of our dental care success in our house was the cavities they had to pay for out of their allowance. Everything else we took care of. So, based on my anecdotal evidence, I can say that there is an infinite probability, that is, a P much greater, or much, much less than zero, that fluoridation prevented caries in my one offspring. That's a correct statement. The statistical analysis is correct. The fact is, the N of equal to 1 gives it no power. So although it's correct, it's not right. So we come back then to the statistical analysis the way statistical analysis is applied depends on who's applying it and to what end. Now, I've used up my 3 minutes of your attention. I'd like to turn then to answering questions that have come up in your mind about this bill, given that my background, remember, is in biochemistry. Prior to coming to OHSU, I was a faculty member in the Center of Molecular Toxicology at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Prior to that, the Environmental Health Sciences Center at Oregon State. I've been a visiting faculty member at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. My research interest has been in toxicology and pharmacology for the last 35 years. I've studied how the body defends itself against toxic materials. Fluoride definitely comes into that heading of toxic material. But then so does iron. So does cobalt. So do any of the trace metals of which we have to have minute amounts to optimize health. What questions can I answer for you? Do you have questions about any particular? I mean, I will keep talking until someone asks me a question. My students learn this very quickly. And if we look at just a quick perusal of the emails that have been submitted to the committee, I think there's some things that need to be addressed right off the top. One of the emails state that as a child I was double-blind tested allergic to fluoride. Now, fluoride does not serve as a haptan. That's been studied half a dozen different times in half a dozen different institutions. A haptan is a small molecule that attaches itself to a protein within the body. The body then makes antibodies against that small molecule protein complex. Fluoride has never been shown to function in that way. In and of itself, it's much too small to elicit an allergic response.
Representative Dalton?
Thanks. Hampton, can you spell it?
Hampton?
Hapten.
Hapten. Hapten. H-A-P-T-E-N.
H-A-P-E.
T-E-N. Hapten.
That's.
The question of allergy to fluoride may very well be like the allergy to penicillin. I was just talking a minute ago. There's a whole generation of us that were thought to be allergic to penicillin as children. Well, in fact, what we were allergic to was the horse serum that the penicillin was always administered in up through about 1956, 57. So the question of allergy and this individual being tested and found to be allergic to fluoride is probably not true. Fluoride is not an antigen. He makes reference to the recent problems with Vioxx and Celebrex and blames regulatory oversight by the FDA. While the malfeasance and nonfeasance in both those cases were on the part of the manufacturer, not the FDA. The FDA has really no investigatory capacity. It relies on the information provided by the manufacturer. So making that comparison really doesn't do much good. The only argument that's made by the people that oppose fluoride that I can't provide a good answer to is that it constitutes medication without consent. Addition of fluoride to water is for the prevention of dental caries, a disease condition. We do that, hopefully, with the consent of the user. But that's not always been the case. If we intend not to fluoridate water because it constitutes a medical treatment without consent of the treated, then let's take the chlorine out of the water process, because it's doing the same thing. Now, let's take the vitamin D out of milk. Milk is not a good supply of vitamin D, but it's a dandy carrier. We put milk and vitamin D to prevent rickets. We put chlorine in water to prevent a panoply of diseases. We put iron in wheat flour to prevent iron deficiency. We supplement widespread materials with potentially toxic substances with real frequency. So if we're not going to fluoridate, let's do it not based on something we already do, that is, medicate without consent, but on a clear and rational assessment of the evidence. So.
Representative Barnhart, did you have questions on heavy metals that you were...
Well, I don't know if this is the appropriate person to ask. If so, then I will. We had testimony a couple of weeks ago, at least, that the common substances that are used, the common materials that are used to fluoridate water in the United States, contain a whole variety of other things besides the compound that contains fluoride, including a number of heavy metals like arsenic, lead, mercury, and the like. I don't recall all the details.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if you're familiar with that, those issues, and if you would have any comments in response to that concern.
Yeah, actually, the question of heavy metal and fluoride is very interesting. Fluoride, the sources of fluoride for water fluoridation are numerous, and I am not the engineer to tell you about that. I can talk to you about the rest of it. The purest form, sodium fluoride, is also among the most expensive. As with most things in government, if there's a cheaper source, sometimes we use it. And fluoride can be supplied as a byproduct of phosphate production, of mining operations, of any number of industrial things. And with that will come contaminations. And these are things that are not trivial, not unimportant. However, I feel somewhat out of place defending fluoride. If you look at one of the most common objections to fluoride is that it's an inhibitor of biochemical reactions that release energy, ATPases, okay? Particularly the F1 ATPase of the mitochondria, the enzyme upon which we all depend for energy. And that's true enough. At about 1 millimolar fluoride, which will translate to, about 6 parts per million fluoride in water. Fluoride by itself is a very poor inhibitor of that enzyme. However, if you put a little bit of aluminum in there, the aluminum and fluoride together become a very potent inhibitor of that enzyme. You can do the same thing with beryllium. Okay. So the fluoride by itself may not be the approximate toxin, but in conjunction with other materials can become very toxic. So to answer your question, depending on the source of the fluoridation material, the more pure the source, the better the chance of recovering it. Because the concerns for heavy metal, concerns about heavy metal contamination is not trivial, but it can also be dealt with. Now, in the other side of that, one of as much as I admire Bill Bakke and the work that Oregon Trout has done, he's raised objections to this because of, or noted that in the areas of the Columbia where aluminum slash, aluminum tailings go into the Columbia, fish tend to avoid that. And part of that aluminum mining material is fluoride. So there is a fairly heavy fluoride concentration going in there. The implication is the fluoride is chasing the fish away. Again, the heavy metals are probably doing a fine job, because if you look at the Madison River, for example, a river that's noted for its fish, has about a 3 part per million fluoride level in it. So fluoride and fish are not absolutely in apposition.
I'm sorry, what river was that you were referring to?
Madison River. It's in Montana and Wyoming. You look at the same thing, the Bitterroot drainage.
Let me follow up. I mean, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, as a layman in the area, my I looked at that, at the information that's being given to us about the fluoride produces a byproduct of other mining.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, what we've been talking about when we're dealing with heavy metals. And you say that heavy metal concerns are not trivial. I was concerned, I guess, because of my belief, maybe inappropriate belief, that adding any amount of heavy metals to drinking water is clearly inappropriate.
And you would be correct in my point of view. The rationale for using the contaminated, or what I would call contaminated, those sources of fluoride with traces of heavy metals has been economic on the part of municipalities. The greater good. Remember, we're marvelously well adapted to defending ourselves. Those heavy metals in the parts per billion range, which is what usually is considered, is dealt with very nicely by the liver, simply by absorption by the defense proteins. We have entire families of proteins whose sole job is picking up heavy metal and eliminating them. So at very low levels, the heavy metals become less of a concern. Arsenic is one that's also brought up fairly frequently. It's interesting to note that the waters of southern Germany are palatable only because arsenic and lead are found together, and they take each other out of the water supply. So the company that a material finds itself in may be as important as how much there is of yourself. The evidence presented by the people opposing fluoride, there's some of the studies that just jump out at you because they're deceptive and in some cases disingenuous. I've developed some of my favorites though. The study in China in 1995 that showed that IQ of children was proportional to fluoride concentration. Probably true, but fluoride, China is one of those areas, particularly the central mountainous regions of China, is one of those areas that has extraordinarily high fluoride levels. So the study covers a range from 0 parts per million fluoride up to 15 parts per million, which is clearly in the toxic range. And IQ effects, which are not disputed, were proportional to the concentration of fluoride, except you didn't see them until you crossed the 10th part per million fluoride level. Other sorts of problems that show up in these. Again, 1994, a study in China and India showed that fluoride decreased fertility, decreased the birth rate. If you look at those studies, first of all, India, because of industrial contamination, has very high groundwater fluoride levels. And the study was done in an area where there was a 10 to 20 part per million, 10 to 20 part per million fluoride level. And these are orders of magnitude different than what we're talking about here. The statement that the NTP, the National Toxicology Program, found fluoride to be an equivocal carcinogen, I read that on a web page and started laughing about it. What the term equivalent... Scientists speak a language of their own, and we shouldn't. It makes our job very hard in settings like this. But it's like taxonomy. Taxonomy is done in Latin because Latin is a dead language, and the meaning of the language never changes. An equivocal carcinogen is one that can't be distinguished from the carrier. When you administer a substance, it has to go in something else. Like milk is a carrier for vitamin D. Well, the standard and prescribed carrier for experiments done by the National Toxicology Testing Program is corn oil. Corn oil is a mild carcinogen. It's an omega-6 fatty acid. Keep that in mind next time you pick up your cooking oil. So the fact that fluoride was no different than the corn oil carrier doesn't mean that fluoride is a carcinogen. It just means it was no different than the carrier. It was an equivocal carcinogen because there were cancers in that treatment. But yet that subtlety, I guess, gets lost on those that see that sort of web page. The Bordeaux study, 1994, Journal of the American Medical Association, showed that fluoride levels down to 0.1 part per million cause an increase in hip fractures. A statistically significant increase in hip fractures. You go, you find the paper, you sort through it, you see that the probability, the statistical probability, was less than or equal to 0.3, which means you're just about the coin flip. You've almost hit the same probability as flipping the coin. Statistically significant, but not powerful. The article was actually later rescinded by the authors. So the list goes on and on. There's no point beating a dead horse. Certainly I didn't die of fluoride toxicity, at least in this state. Are there other questions I can answer for you? We can talk about fluoride clearance, how the body deals with fluoride normally. Fluoride is cleared by the kidney very efficiently. About 50% of the circulating dose of fluoride is cleared with each pass through the kidney, roughly translated to keep a serum level in excess of one part per million, you would have to drink about 250 liters of water a day to keep up with the kidney's clearance and maintain and saturate the body. We clear fluoride very effectively. What else do we... Failing questions, I'm really ready to go sit down if that's...
okay.
You know, being involved in the fluoride wars is sort of interesting. The first death threat was sort of a novelty. After that, it just got to be kind of an annoyance. It's very hard to challenge what someone believes because they believe it. But I hope that's what we elect you all to do. To do the right and rational thing, even though you may not believe it, even though it's hard sometimes to put aside what you may feel, you know, otherwise, and look at the evidence. The evidence is that fluoridation is safe, effective, and especially well adapted to preventing dental caries, a significant childhood and adult health issue. Having said that, I thank you for the opportunity to bend your ear for a few minutes.
Well, we thank you, Mike, for being here. And if you're not going anywhere, if you know, have nothing else to do but hear the rest of the testimony, if there are questions that come up later.
I have 4 hours on the meter.
You're in great shape.
For the rest of the afternoon.
Thank you, Derek. With this, we have Kip Duchon. Is that
Yes, I would like to introduce our division director, Dr. William Moss, who is the good to come to the microphone,
sir.
I'm Dr. Bill Moss from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and I'm director of the Division of Oral Health. Kip Duchon is a national fluoridation engineer, and if I could suggest that we each have prepared testimony that relates to the questions that we're most commonly asked. And if it's okay with you, we'd like to present that testimony and then be open to questions. Hopefully we'll answer many of the questions in the course of our prepared testimony.
We would appreciate it if you would do that. Who wants to lead off?
Thank you. I'm pleased to have this opportunity to discuss the topic of community water fluoridation and dental health with you. Within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, CDC is recognized as the lead federal agency for protecting the health and safety of people, which it accomplishes by providing credible information to enhance health decisions and by promoting health through strong partnerships. CDC serves as the national focus for developing and applying disease prevention and control strategies for environmental health and for health promotion and education activities to improve the health of the people of the United States. CDC has recognized fluoridation of drinking water to prevent dental caries as one of 10 great public health achievements of the 20th century. Over the past 50 years, adjusted fluoridation of community drinking water has been a major factor responsible for the decline in tooth decay. Although other fluoride-containing products are available, water fluoridation remains the most equitable and cost-effective method for delivering fluoride to all members of most communities, regardless of age, educational experience, or income level. Our understanding of community water fluoridation is based on more than 60 years of research. CDC's endorsement of water fluoridation is based on assessment of that scientific evidence by many independent committees of experts, by review of the findings of individual studies, and the research conducted by our own scientists. And it is this body of evidence, more than the findings of any single study, which affirms that community water fluoridation prevents tooth decay, is safe, reaches people from all walks of life throughout the lifespan, and is very cost-effective. U.S. Surgeon General Richard Carmona recently joined many previous Surgeons General in issuing a personal statement endorsing fluoridation. In addition, in 2003, Surgeon General Carmona provided leadership by releasing a national call to action to promote oral health. In that call to action, he challenged all sectors of society to work together to replicate what works, so that together we can promote oral health widely and effectively. Furthermore, the Surgeon General has affirmed that it is the responsibility of community leaders, whether their venue is at the state level or closer to home, to provide leadership for efforts to expand the reach of effective measures. Community water fluoridation is effective in reducing tooth decay, and this has been affirmed over the years by dozens of expert committees and task forces in the United States and elsewhere that have conducted independent reviews of the scientific literature. Their well-documented reports are available for reference. Each year, the standards of review of the evidence are set higher. Recently, a non-federal task force on community prevent services was convened by the Department of Health and Human Services to provide leadership in evaluating community, population, and healthcare system strategies to address a variety of public health and health promotion topics. After a critical and thorough review of the scientific evidence of effectiveness, the task force strongly recommended community water fluoridation for prevention and control of tooth decay. Similar comprehensive reviews have been conducted in recent years in the United Kingdom and in Ireland, and all these have reached the same conclusions regarding the effectiveness of fluoridation. Community water fluoridation is safe. The safety of fluoride in drinking water is at levels recommended for the prevention of tooth decay has been affirmed by the National Research Council, an affiliate of the National Academy of Sciences and the Institute of Medicine. Because fluoride sometimes occurs naturally in water, at levels many times higher than those recommended for preventing tooth decay, the Environmental Protection Agency asked the National Research Council to thoroughly review the health effects of these higher levels in drinking water and to advise the EPA regarding the maximum level to be permitted. This first review was conducted in 1993, and a periodic reassessment of this issue, which will consider new information available since the previous report, currently is being conducted by the National Research Council. If any new recommendations arise from this current study, they are likely to focus on health effects of fluoride when it occurs naturally at levels many times higher than recommended levels. The safety of community water fluoridation at recommended levels is not seriously challenged. Community water fluoridation is cost-effective. CDC scientists estimate that for most cities considering the initiation of water fluoridation, the community can expect to save about $38 in averted dental treatment costs for every $1 invested in fluoridation. How many other public or private investments can be expected to yield that kind of return? One study by CDC scientists examined Medicaid costs for preschool children in Louisiana. The study found that children in non-fluoridated parishes had Medicaid dental care costs that were twice as high, on average, as those of children living in fluoridated parishes. And in addition to the severity of their decay, required children from non-fluoridated parishes to be hospitalized three times as often for dental treatment as other children. Community water fluoridation is an investment that returns savings in both private and public dental care expenses. And community water fluoridation is not just for children. Modern science has advanced our understanding of how fluoride works to prevent and control tooth decay. While incorporating fluoride into developing teeth of young children has been shown to prevent tooth decay independently, fluoride's ability to work topically on the surface of the tooth is what provides its main effects and results in its effectiveness throughout the lifespan. CDC scientists recently reviewed a number of studies on the rate of new tooth decay in older adults and determined that the decay rate in older adults is actually greater than the decay rate for children. In Oregon, 55% of seniors age 65 and over still have most of their natural teeth. With each new age group of older adults retaining more natural teeth than the generations before them, fluoridation's benefits across the lifespan become increasingly important. It has been noted that the use of fluoride toothpaste, fluoride rinses, and professionally applied fluoride products is now widespread in the United States, and therefore it's reasonable to ask whether fluoridation continues to be effective under these modern circumstances. To address this issue, CDC scientists have analyzed data from a large national study and have confirmed the effectiveness of fluoridation. Our modern lifestyle also leads us to eat many meals outside the home and provides convenient foods and beverages that were processed in other cities, the majority of which are processed with fluoridated water. This has resulted in a diffusion or halo effect in which fluoridation provides benefits not only to those drinking water from their household tap, but also to others who, while they may not have fluoride in their drinking water, nevertheless receive partial benefits by eating foods and drinking beverages processed elsewhere with fluoridated water. Consequently, fluoridated communities provide benefits not only to their own residents, but to residents in neighboring communities as well. Now, if fluoride is available from all these sources, are people getting too much? No, not from their diet or drinking water. For people living in fluoridated communities, total fluoride intake has remained quite constant over the past couple of generations. Fluoride intake in non-fluoridated communities has risen due to the diffusion effect of processed foods and beverages that I mentioned earlier, but it still remains lower than for those people living in fluoridated communities. We do not believe that anyone is getting too much fluoride from the use of optimally fluoridated drinking water. However, we do have evidence that some young children are using fluoride toothpaste inappropriately without adequate adult supervision and are swallowing too much. Also, some young children who reside in fluoridated communities are continuing to receive fluoride supplements, perhaps because their parent or physician or their dentist has inaccurate information about the fluoride content of their drinking water source. In these conditions, cosmetic blemishes on the developing permanent teeth can occur. This condition is called enamel fluorosis, and it occurs in about one-fourth of American children. In most cases, the blemishes are so mild that they are neither a cosmetic nor a functional problem. Moderate and severe forms, which occur in less than 2% of children, can be a cosmetic problem, but they are just as likely to occur in a low fluoride community as a high fluoride community because it's related to these other sources. To keep this from being a larger problem, CDC has encouraged more careful use of fluoride toothpaste. We recommend that health professionals tell parents about the importance of following the instructions found on the tube and carefully supervise their children's brushing. And we've also produced educational materials to inform parents on the right amount of fluoride toothpaste to use, a pea-sized amount. As people in communities across the nation begin to consider the various policy options available to promote oral health, they will hear from opponents of fluoridation. I understand you have. And I want you to know that we have heard all of the arguments before. As your last speaker said, when you take the studies and pick them apart one by one, after a while you ask yourself, why do you keep going at what study after study? Because after the credibility of someone offering those kinds of flawed studies is put into question, you can see that they're just trying to use alarming words. They're not interested in improving public understanding. Their goal is to plant doubts in your mind. In the course of collecting information, you will hear assertions from two sources, and you should make a clear distinction between them. One source is self-proclaimed experts who are single-minded regarding this issue, who rely on their own interpretation of articles and who quote selectively from what other individual scientists have said. The other source is drawn from reports prepared by teams of distinguished scientists who are selected on the basis of their expertise to look at all scientific sides of these issues and who debate the evidence as they draft the report. Before the study is complete, other independent scientists evaluate both the method they use in reaching conclusions and the specific conclusions reached. We have high confidence in the evaluation of science that occurs through such processes, whatever their findings might be. In the case of community water fluoridation, every such panel of experts that has met to review and critique the evidence has concluded that community water fluoridation is safe and effective. The reports of the Task Force on Community Preventive Services, the Subcommittee of the National Research Council, and those from England and Ireland all meet these high standards. The responsibility of CDC, like your health department and health professional associations, is to be a trustworthy source of information on how to improve health. We take that trust very seriously and stand ready to be a continued resource to you in your efforts to improve the oral health of your citizens. And now I'd like to ask that you hear a statement from our National Fluoridation Engineer, and then we'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Please, good.
Good afternoon. I'm Kip Duchon. I'm a registered professional environmental engineer with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, charged with the responsibility of fluoridation engineering on the national level. I want to let you know that my career has been very heavily involved with water and wastewater utilities, management, environmental issues, and over half of my entire career was very fortunately with a local Oregon company called CH2M Hill, which was founded 60 years ago in Corvallis and has now grown to be the largest and most respected environmental engineering firm in the world. So you can be very proud of that company and its national recognition, its international recognition of leadership. I've been asked to discuss engineering considerations on the safety of fluoride products and CDC's support of the community water fluoridation programs. You do have the copy of my comments ahead of you. There will be one insertion that I'm going to make, and that's because you have asked questions about the metals and contaminants. I had some discussion on it, but I'm going to clarify what that answer exactly. The addition of fluoride to drinking water uses standard water industry equipment and materials. It does not present unusual complexity or require operator capability over other standard water treatment processes. Tanks, pipes, and pumps are all made from common materials that are in use at a typical water treatment facility. A common installation will include a storage tank for bulk storage, a metering pump to deliver a precise amount of fluoride to the finished water, and safety features such as a fluoride monitoring level. A good engineering practice is to secure all additives at a water treatment facility, so typically there will be separate storage of fluoride in a designated room, similar to how other additives are handled at the same facility. Like their counterparts in other states, the Oregon Department of Human Services Drinking Water Program is the primary agency responsible for the review of modifications and improvements to water systems, and all facility construction or improvements are reviewed to ensure the highest quality and standards. Because we have 60 years of water fluoridation experience, there is considerable guidance on good engineering practices related to design, construction, operation, and maintenance of water fluoridation systems. The best reference is published by the American Water Works Association and is known as the Manual of Practice No. 4, Water Fluoridation Principle and Practices, with the updated fifth edition recently published in February of 2004. This document and other industry guidance documents ensures that engineers and utility plant operators have the best information available to ensure good facilities for water fluoridation. Community water systems use one of three fluoride products to achieve optimal fluoride levels: sodium fluoride, sodium fluorosilicate, and fluorosilicic acid, which is also known as hydrofluorosilicic acid and sometimes is referred to the acronym FSA. Fluorosilicic acid has been used for water fluoridation since the early 1950s and is currently the predominant additive used for water fluoridation. Since the early 1980s, all fluoride additives used in the U.S. have been derived from fluorosilicic acid, produced as a co-product in the manufacture of the fertilizer industry. This process provides a high purity fluorosilicic acid at a reasonable cost. That's the reason people went to it, the higher quality than ore-grade material. You may hear charges that the fluoride additives are a way to dispose of industrial waste. Nothing can be further from the truth. fertilizer manufacturing processes apatite rock, which is a calcium mineral, to produce a phosphate-rich slurry, which is ultimately dried to form fertilizer pellets. Hydrogen fluoride gas and silicon tetrafluoride are captured from the slurry and then condensed to the fluorosilicic acid. They do this for one principal reason. They have to dry that slurry to the dry granular product that you buy in the store, and it costs energy to dry the product. By evaporating some of the water out of there, along with the fluorosilicic acid, they reduce their energy costs, but it comes off at a very, it's evaporative, deliberate evaporative process to collect that high purity product. Only half of the fertilizer facilities even do this, because there's no real big market for fluorosilicic acid, so it's not at all a profitable thing for them. The fluorosilicic acid is then either transported to water treatment plants or is further processed to receive dry fluoride products that are also purchased. The question of toxicity, purity, and risk to humans from the addition of fluoride to drinking water sometimes arises. To ensure the public safety, all additives used at a water treatment plant must meet strict quality standards. Almost all of the over 40 water treatment additives that are routinely used at a water treatment plant are toxic to humans in some concentrated form. Chlorine gas is used for disinfection is a good example. Because of the high standards and capabilities of professional associations in the industry, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, no longer directly regulates additives to drinking water. The Federal Food and Drug Administration, FDA, does not regulate additives to drinking water, since their regulatory purview concerns only food, drug, or cosmetic-related products. To ensure the public's protection, all additives used in drinking water treatment are subject to a system of standards, testing, and certifications by the American Water Works Association and the National Sanitation Foundation International. Both of these entities are not-for-profit, non-governmental organizations. The American Water Works Association sets minimum requirements for a product's design, installation, performance, and manufacturing, while NSF International Standards 60 and 61 ensure the purity of drinking water additives or products. NSF International Standards 60 and 61 were developed by a consortium of associations, including the American Water Works Association, the American National Standards Institute, the Association of State Drinking Water Administrators, and the Conference of State Health and Environmental Managers. This consortium prepared Standards 60 and 61 in response to the request by the EPA for a basis to establish minimum requirements for the control of effects from products added to water for its treatment, thereby ensuring the public's protection. NSF International mandates testing of all water fluoridation products. Their independent testing has documented that the impurities that EPA regulates in drinking water are only detected in less than one-third of all samples that are analyzed. The samples with positive detection, which is less than a third, would result in less than one-quarter of one-tenth of the level established as safe in water, including a safety factor by the Environmental Protection Agency. And that is the most that would be added. Two-thirds of the samples would result in considerably less additive. So it's really a question that's begging the point. Health effects of fluoride have been extensively studied over the past 60 years. At the levels used for community water fluoridation, it has been found to be safe and effective in reducing tooth decay. Since fluoride sometimes occurs naturally at much higher levels, the EPA has conservatively established a maximum contaminant level for fluoride of 4 milligrams per liter. In Oregon, fluoridated water systems maintain a level of 0.9 to 1.5 milligrams per liter, which is well below the regulated levels. To put this in perspective, a milligram per liter is also referred to as one part per million, is about the same as the length of a pickup truck as the distance from Salem to New York City. In my job, I answer many questions by news reporters, and something I hear a lot is the wish by those reporters that they had learned more in high school or college chemistry to better prepare them for my answers. So here's a short chemistry lecture. The claim is sometimes made that no health studies exist on silica fluoride additives used in water fluoridation. Yet there have been considerable health effect studies of sodium fluoride. It is important to understand that at the pH, temperature, and very low fluoride concentration used in water fluoridation, the additives achieve virtually complete dissolution and ionic disassociation. In other words, they separate into fluoride and other product ions, for example, sodium, hydrogen, or silica. Consequently, the health effect studies for sodium fluoride in drinking water are directly applicable and sufficient since the fluoride ions are chemically identical. Part of my job at the CDC is supporting the various state fluoridation programs. An important element of this program is participation in the CDC Water Fluoridation Reporting System, also known by its acronym in the industry as WAFERS. This CDC program, developed in response to requests by state programs, is an important tool in managing water fluoridation within a state. WAFERS assist in tracking fluoridation within a state, what is happening at each facility in terms of quality assurance and verification, and allows the state program to analyze the collected data to identify communities that need additional assistance and to maintain and achieve the most benefit to public health. The state of Oregon has already made plans to increase its use of WAFERS, and this will be an important support for effective water fluoridation as additional communities initiate this important effort. With 60 years of history, water fluoridation has been proven to be simple and a straightforward process that is efficient and effective. It uses standard equipment and materials and is well within the capabilities of water facility operators to operate and maintain. The additives must meet high standards for quality and safety. Community water fluoridation in the U.S. has a long and proud history of success in providing important and improved oral health outcomes.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kip, I have a question to ask of you, and I apologize for my ignorance in advance. I did not study chemistry either in high school or college. So you're starting from ground zero with me. And on page four, up at the top, you wish that news reporters had studied chemistry, and so do I, but I did not. So
I tell my daughters that's an important lesson. They
you are absolutely right, and if I had to do it over again, but I don't. So talk to me some more about all that you say in that paragraph.
Okay, let me explain real simply. When you're looking at chemistry, you're talking about mostly the physical chemistry. And let me start by saying this way. Think of water. On a very simple level, if all you do is make one change, and that's by temperature, water can be steam, it can be a liquid, it can be solid, ice. Those are fundamentally different in nature and character. And that's only with one thing changing, temperature. When you're talking about other chemicals that are in the water, when you're changing the pH, when you're changing the temperature, when you're changing the concentration, they change in character and form tremendously. Drinking water is an excellent example with chlorine, because we add a chlorine gas which reacts with the water, and the chlorine gas becomes a hypochlorous acid. No longer chlorine gas. It becomes something completely different with water, hypochlorous acid. And then the pH can change, because it depends on what other chemistry is in that water and how well buffered it is. If it's a more acidic level, it will be a true hypochlorous acid. If it goes into a more basic level, it might go to be neutralized, and it would still be a hypochlorite, but not a hypochlorous acid. So it changes complete character in just drinking water, and it happens all the time. And we sometimes, in water treatment, will deliberately adjust the pH to make sure that we're getting what level of hypochlorous acids versus what proportion of hypochlorite. that we want to have in there. The same way with fluoride additives, the sodium fluorosilicates and the hydrogen fluorosilicates, researchers at the Environmental Protection Agency in Cincinnati, Urbanski and Shook, as well as Dr. Mike Morrissey, who's a professor at University of Ann Arbor, in University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, have both studied the disassociation of silica fluorides in water. And they both have shown that at a concentrated acid form, it is a silica fluoride, but when you add it to water at the concentration for optimal fluoridation and at the temperatures and pH that drinking water presents itself, it no longer exists as a silica fluoride. It dissociates into the individual ions. So all you've got is sodium.
And what does that mean? I don't know what that means.
Dissociation means it just comes apart, and it has to do with the van der Waal forces on. If you're looking at a water molecule, it's H2O. The oxygen is negative, and then the two hydrogens are on the same side, associated with each other as a positive. So if you look at each water molecule, each one is a dielectric, where you have a positive.
I don't know what that means.
That's a positive side and a negative side.
Okay.
I mean, they actually have an electrical charge. That's part of the reason that water conducts electricity. And so what happens is the negative side of that water will attract one set of ions, and the positive side, where the hydrogen is, will collect other ions. And so what happens is when something such as chlorine or silica fluorides or something goes in there, they will separate and try to associate with different sides of the water molecule. And that's the reason it no longer exists as a silica fluoride. It changes in character completely and has a different association with the water.
I know a lot less chemistry than Kip, and I might be able to explain it a little bit differently.
Thank you, Kip.
The fluoride, when he says fluoride ion, what he's really talking about is a fluoride atom. I mean, a single atom of fluoride, but with the negative charge. Because each type of element has either wants to attract electrons or give up electrons. It's kind of its natural state. I guess another simple way to think about it is if you put table salt into water, it's sodium chloride. When it goes into the water and is no longer the crystal, it's because the sodium and the chlorine have each separated, and they each of those atoms relates to the water atoms or water molecules depending on their charge. And so the simple view is that the silica fluosilic acid, after that is introduced into the water, the fluoride ion, that fluoride atom with the electrical charge, is the same fluoride ion or atom as if you use sodium fluoride, a different compound with fluoride. And so the people that have been saying that we haven't studied the safety or the health effects of the silica fluosilic acids are arguing that somehow or another we should expect fluoride ions to be different if they're introduced into the water from this fluosilic acid than if they were introduced as sodium fluoride.
Mm-hmm.
And although chemists have pretty much concluded that there's complete disassociation, because of the concerns that were raised, both the Environmental Protection Agency's own scientists and the professor from the University of Michigan was hired as an independent analyst, have looked at that question. We try to be responsive to concerns raised by the public or by other scientists. The National Toxicology Program and the Environmental Protection Agency have both tried to be responsive to these charges that the fluosilic acid has different health effects. And when the chemists have looked at the chemistry, they can't see any difference. The fluoride ion is a fluoride ion. If the National Toxicology Program wanted to do a safety study of the fluosilic acid, in order to justify spending millions of dollars, they'd have to have some belief that the health effects from that studying that product would be different than studying the sodium fluoride, which has already been studied.
Mm-hmm.
Because the chemists say the fluoride ion is exactly the same, then it would be very wasteful to say, well, let's use this type of fluoride and spend millions and millions of dollars to see if it has health effects. The chemists have said the fluoride ion is going to give you the same health effect regardless, and we already have, 60-plus years of research experience with sodium fluoride.
The reason we use those three additives that we use, sodium fluoride, sodium fluorosilicate, and fluorosilicic acid, is because they all completely dissolve in the water. There are other fluoride products that we do not use, and we don't use them because they're not appropriate for water fluoridation as far as we're concerned. But it's an incorrect statement to say that the fluorosilicic acid continues to persist in water when you add it to water at the levels for water fluoridation.
I think I understand some. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Belko.
Mr. Chair, you testified that there are as many as 40 additives to water that systems across the country are putting in. Can you give us a couple of examples of what those might be aside from chlorine?
Well, there's many examples, but, besides chlorine, you could have ozone for disinfection also. There, we use aluminum sulfate or iron sulfates and iron chlorides, ferric sulfate, ferric chlorides. All of those are used for the aluminum sulfate, and then the ferrous salts are all used for precipitation of turbidity contributing factors. Then we add things like lime and caustic soda for pH adjustment and buffering of the acids, because the ferric compounds and the aluminum compounds are insoluble, but they are acidic, and so you have to buffer them. You can also use there are also things like potassium permanganate, which is an oxidant that's oftentimes put in for taste and odor control. Chlorine dioxide is oftentimes used in there for algae. There's polymers which are put in that are basically polymerized organic materials that are used for also adding in as a flocculant aid and coagulant aid for turbidity removal. I can go on. I mean, do you want me to? I may not remember all 40 of them, but you've got to understand, let me just say, in water treatment, there's a lot of objectives you're looking at. You're looking at two things with water treatment. One is you're wanting to ensure that it meets the health and safety requirements, and the other is that you want to make sure that it satisfies the consumer's preferences on how water should taste. Water itself doesn't have any taste. It's all the contaminants in water that you taste. Mm-hmm. And most people, when they say, "Oh, I like the way this water tastes," it's because they're loving those contaminants. And that's okay. We're creatures of nature, and we grew up, drinking this stuff. And, what I always love is with the hydrogen sulfide. And you probably have smelled that. It smelled the sulfur smell that you sometimes get in some places. Some people hate it. And yet you go to Europe and they go to spas so they can drink the stuff and smell it because it's medicinal in their opinion. So it's a matter of consumer preference. Do you want to sniff the hydrogen sulfide because it's medicinal? Or do you want to get rid of it, which we can do. By either aeration or the volatile or oxidation of the reduced product, so that the consumer doesn't have to smell that medicinal character.
Follow up. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Kip, on these various preparations that municipal water systems put into their drinking water, ozone, aluminum sulfate, iron sulfates, chlorides, lime, caustic soda, potassium preparations, all. Do you have people sort of worried about those additives into the water system?
I don't know of anyone who complains. Well, there are people who don't like the taste of chlorine, but it along with water fluoridation was probably one of the most effective public health interventions in the history of medicine. because before we started disinfecting water, cholera epidemics and other illnesses and diseases were just endemic, happened all the time. People don't complain about those.
Thank you. Representative Dinkfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, and I have a couple questions. And just to let you know, I used to work at TH2M Hill, so I'm very pleased
good.
To be a former
great
colleague.
Company.
I have a question, just trying to get this straight in my head, about where exactly regulation of fluoride fits in, because it really seems like this is very confusing for citizens and a bureaucratic maze. So I just want to make sure that I'm clear on this. So EPA does not set drinking water standards for added fluoride. Is that correct?
That's correct. The EPA used to have, prior to 1978, they used to be the entity that CDC is now for water fluoridation, promoting and supporting water fluoridation. The reason that they got out of it is because they felt that they should not be advocating putting something in if what their real mission was identifying what the health effects at the maximum level should be, because they didn't want people to say that they had a potential conflict of interest. And that's why the program came over to CDC. Their whole focus on that is what is the health effects issues. Fluoride and copper are examples of beneficial nutrients that are naturally occurring in water, where the level where unfavorable health effects is somewhat close to the beneficial level. And so the EPA looks very carefully at their maximum contaminant levels, especially with the nutritive properties, and they say, what is the level that protects the people's health? Not how much should we add, because that's not what their focus is. They absolutely have are not at all adverse to water fluoridation. Their whole focus is what's the level that's acceptable.
If I could add to that, the Safe Drinking Water Act was passed at about that time in the late 70s, and as a federal legislation, and there was a proponent in the federal legislature that basically made sure that the Safe Drinking Water Act has a clause that says nothing in this act should give the EPA the authority to force anyone to fluoridate the water. Again, because it wasn't an issue of protecting from adverse health effects, but rather to provide the benefits of fluoride. So the EPA is a regulatory agency, but it does not regulate the addition of fluoride to achieve optimal levels. It only regulates naturally occurring fluoride, which can occur at much higher levels. The Centers for Disease Control is not a regulatory agency. Whether we're talking about SARS or influenza virus or influenza or anthrax or anything, our job is to understand the science, to provide credible information, to work with partners to improve health. So we provide information, but we do not regulate. So that's what separates fluoride from all of the other things that the EPA regulates. So similarly, in the state, if the state has taken over the responsibility of enforcing the Safe Drinking Water Act, in other words, state Environmental Health Agency says, federal government, you don't need to enforce that. We will enforce that. They cannot enforce anything related to the fluoridation of water, the optimal fluoridation, under the Safe Drinking Water Act. That would be done as a program of the state. And as Mr. Duchon said, each state environmental health or water department, depending on how the state's organized, when it comes to fluoridation, they follow these other standards that are well-accepted standards from the international and national not-for-profit associations that provide guidance, really, on how to properly fluoridate and what the purity of chemicals to use.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow.
I have several follow-up questions. So I'm reading right here the AWWA, which is the American Water Works Association. It's their Standards Committee on Fluorides, which review and approve the standard. And I'm just curious, who advises this body? Because if I'm understanding you right, EPA, US EPA just does the maximum contaminant level. You're not a regulatory agency, so CDC does not regulate. And the FDA does not regulate this as an additive. Is that correct?
Right.
So the question I have is, and I'm familiar with the AWWA, I've gone to many other conferences, who advises the AWWA in establishing those standards? Is it the National Science NSF folks? I mean, who is responsible for advising the AWWA?
Well, there's a lot of questions that you asked in that one. First of all, AWWA and NSF International have different focuses. Also, AWWA and NSF International are not related to the standards of drinking water for oral health benefits. That comes from the health effects side and the research on where the beneficial levels are. So AWWA and NSF International are not involved with the health sides, the promotion and the healthy sides. What they're looking at is what do they need to do to protect the public's health, if you're going to be adding fluoride products. The AWWA, as I mentioned, is really focused on the production and manufacturing and the quality of the product that is needed for the use at by a water facility. The NSF International is really focused on the standards related to the health effects, so that we're not adding anything to the water which would compromise the public's health. So they both look for the when they do have questions on those particular elements, they would be getting the appropriate input from other entities. As I mentioned with NSF International, and let me just refer back to that, they include the state drinking water administrators and the Conference of State Health and Environmental Managers as part of that consortium that looks at that whole issue. So the NSF International on the health effects does have a lot of input from the health side and the public health and safety side of the fence.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. And then I have one separate question. So if there's other...
Representative.
Okay, yes. Thank you. And my colleague, Representative Barnhart, touched on this in a prior question about the heavy metals that can be found in some of the substances. And I got on the website and looked at the LCI, which is the fluoride specialist, where a lot of the fluoride comes from as an additive for drinking water, and looked at their product data sheets. And all three of them, the three chemicals that are used, the sodium fluoride, the sodium silicate, and the fluorosilic acid, they all have small amounts of heavy metals. And I know that the MCL for heavy metals that EPA puts out is zero. So
that's not true. The MCL... The EPA does not have a maximum contaminant level of zero for anything, because we can actually measure down to levels that are remarkably low. So when you're talking about heavy metals, EPA actually identifies levels of concentrations that need to as maximum contaminant level for water.
So they're in the parts per billion?
Yes, they're in parts per billion level.
I think what's confusing there, the MCLG, the maximum contaminant level goal, there has been statements that there's no known safe level of arsenic. So as a goal, it's been, since it's not known what tiny level would be safe, they've set it at zero. But that's not only unattainable, but it's unmeasurable. The actual MCL, I believe, for arsenic, for example, is 50 parts per billion. It's been proposed to go 10 parts per billion. But so the goal is related to this idea that we don't know what the safe level is, but the maximum contaminant level that is allowed is a much higher level. The small amounts that are in the additive, those additives are diluted about, in some cases, 200,000 to 300,000. I mean, you know, one drop of this additive for two or 300,000 times as much water. So starting with a very small amount, by the time it's diluted hundreds of thousands of times, every community that's tried to measure it has been unable to detect it in the finished water.
And just a clarification, you're right. I misspoke, because the MCL goal is zero, although I think many people say there is really no safe level for heavy metals in drinking water. But my question was, looking at these three different product sheets, one of them has a much lower level of heavy metals as lead than the other two products, and I would think that, if anything, we'd want to promote the use of the either fluorosilic acid or the sodium fluorosilicate that has lower levels of heavy metals.
Let me clarify some of what you're looking at. Okay. When they put together their product sheets for products of this nature, and that's not just for this one industry but any industry, what they actually will do is they will indicate a product purity which is at the worst possible edge of the envelope of what they could potentially be delivering. It's not uncommon that if you look at some of those forms, that they'll say it's 97% pure. When in fact, when you talk to the actual manufacturers, it's usually the actual product assays are more like 99.99% pure. But the reason that they do that is that there may be, you know, out of several hundred samples, you might have one sample that would be higher, and they don't want to have somebody buy something presuming that it's going to be 99.99% pure, and that's the one that they got that's 97% pure. So they report the worst case scenario. I think what's more revealing than those product sheets from the manufacturers off of a website is the NSF International actual testing of fluoride products. That's part of the certification that was put together with standards 60 and 61, is that there will be an extensive amount of data collected on true measurement, and not by the manufacturers. This is independently done. The manufacturers have to get certified by paying NSF International. They collect the samples at blind to the manufacturers. They don't know when they're being collected. They don't know how they're being collected. All they know is that the NSF International has a blind collection to the entities, and then they report back whether they've met their certification. What's interesting about that is that Blake Stark at NSF International has given me a lot of data on what they've collected. And if you look at the samples, they have a problem with releasing that to the public because of confidentiality agreements. They don't want individual manufacturers to be singled out. That's part of their product requirements. But what's interesting about the testing that NSF International has done is that they only measure these impurities that you're talking about in less than a third of all the samples they test. So it's not like these products are ubiquitously contaminated with a lot of really bad buddies. I mean, yes, you will on occasion have detection of some of these materials, but it's not typically the case. And I think if you look at anything, you're going to find a certain level of contamination in some samples of everything that you see. The FDA regulates the amounts of these things in the food you're eating. I mean, there's arsenic in food that you're eating, and the FDA regulates that whole issue. You've got to realize that when EPA says that the maximum contaminant goal for arsenic is zero, that doesn't mean that they believe it should be zero. And if you look on their website, they're very specific about that for arsenic in particular. The reason they say zero is because there's no firmly established scientific basis to say what the safe threshold level is. They don't presume that some safe threshold level doesn't exist. But they have no ability to scientifically and conclusively state what that safe threshold level is, and that's why they say zero as a goal, which they say is unattainable and unrealistic. It's on their website.
Thank you. I have one final question.
Final question.
This is regarding a request for assistance that the EPA put out in 2002, and I don't know if you're familiar with it or not, but I was looking through some of the information over the weekend and found this, and I thought it was curious that EPA... Are you familiar with this request for assistance?
tell me a little bit more.
Well, it's a request for assistance to measure for silicates in drinking water that was put out by the Office of Research and Development by the EPA.
That's by Joyce Donahue. She wanted somebody to check the Urbanski and Shook information.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And that's when they hired Michael Morrissey of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And
can
so
you talk
that,
a little
and that
bit
was
about
done because they wanted to provide support to the National Resource Council committee, which is looking at the reassessment of fluoride at maximum contaminant level.
This wasn't an issue at all until the late 90s. You've heard of Masters and Copeland?
Mm-hmm.
Professor Master is a professor emeritus in Dartmouth. It's a specialty in juvenile delinquency. Myron Copeland is a retired chemist from Natick, Massachusetts. They got together, and Myron Copeland decided that fluosilicic acid was bad, and that it did behave differently, that it didn't completely disassociate, and somehow it through some process was able to be metabolized differently. They used ecological study, basically had information about communities and made the claim that there was an association of the type of fluoride chemical used with blood lead levels in children. And they got a lot of attention from that. When you're a professor emeritus from Dartmouth, you know, you have a lot of credibility. We actually, to try to be responsive to the public concern, we encouraged both of those gentlemen to go to the National Toxicology Program, which is part of the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences. And they questioned, the scientists there questioned, to try to understand exactly what it is that Myron Copeland thought was occurring chemically so that they would know how to design the studies. And the first kind of step in making a decision about that is what they call chemical characterization studies. So there was actually an interest both in the part of the National Toxicology Program, of part of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, which is part of the National Institutes of Health, and the Environmental Protection Agency, both had an interest in answering this question about whether the fluosilicic acid chemistry, whether the fluoride chemistry was really different, and to characterize it, fully characterize it. So that's, in other words, it was an open, what you saw there was an open process to try to have somebody propose that they were a scientist qualified to answer that question.
And do you know, has this study been completed?
Yes.
What's
mm-hmm.
the results been?
That the fluoride ion is a fluoride ion, that it completely disassociates probably by the time the water gets out of the pump house, but certainly by the time it goes all the way down the miles down the road to the house. There's absolutely no question but that the fluoride completely disassociates. That scientist further went on. One of the things that Myron Copeland looked back on was a World War II era study in Germany, somebody's doctoral dissertation, that had speculated about this lack of complete disassociation. And the professor at the University of Michigan was actually able to go through that and find the error in the analysis that was done back in, I guess it was the 30s or the 40s. So I view this really as other parts of the government, this wasn't CDC, but this is other parts of your federal government, being as responsible as possible in listening to those charges and trying to understand whether there was any merit to doing further research. And at the point of the chemical characterization, they received information that it's really pointless to assume that fluoride is going to have any different health effects when it comes from that source than it came from sodium fluoride.
Thank you.
If you look at the Urbanski and Shook information, and there are EPA chemists who have studied this very extensively, at the concentrations in drinking water, all of this happens on the millisecond level. But if you're looking at actually adding the additives to water from the concentrated form, in a matter of 2 to 5 minutes, all of it has all the reactions have fully completed themselves. It's a very rapid at the concentrations within drinking water. It's a very fast process.
Thank you.
And Dr. Morris at University of Michigan confirmed what Urbanski and Shook found.
It was like a peer review, basically. Rather than just trust their own scientist, let's let an independent scientist do the same study.
Thank you.
Other question? Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize. I'm just getting over a cold.
So am I.
If I sound a little strange, attribute it to that, please. I'm looking at the same charts that Representative Dingfelder referred to a minute ago, and I'm trying to do the math, and I'm not doing it very well, I think because of the cold today. These products are concentrated materials. When you add them to water in order to make the dilute material that people are actually going to drink, we're talking about diluting them one part per a million parts water. Approximately.
For the fluorosilicic acid, you're roughly diluting fluorosilicic acid one part to 240,000. So take whatever you've got. If you've got a concentration of let's say hypothetically 40 milligrams per liter of something, which would be seem like an awfully high number, divide that by 240,000, and that's going to be the concentration to a customer. Now, let me just caution you, 240,000 is not what the typical person would see. They probably see it more like half a million. And the reason is the 240,000 is if you're living in Alaska, where we have a higher application rate. The colder the environment, the higher the fluoride we put in. If you're living in Alaska and you have absolutely no fluoride naturally occurring, you would have to have that dilution of 240,000. If you live in a place like Oregon, which has a lower requirement of adding fluoride, and you would also have naturally occurring fluoride here. I mean, the Cascades, most of the water here has some amount of fluoride in many of the places in the state. And you're going to probably have considerably less fluoride additive than that. So you could probably, for your citizens, divide it by half a million, 500,000, and that would be your dilution factor at the state. That's a rule of thumb.
I was recently reading a report that was done in Ireland, a 2002 study, and they use the FSA exclusively there. And again, you said you're kind of doing the math. The levels of these contaminants are not detectable, even with our most sophisticated methods in the finished water. So the analysis that was done in Ireland was basically that in the finished product, the levels of those heavy metal contaminants are 0.1% of the WHO guidelines for what would be the maximum that would be allowed in the water. And you can only get to that number by doing the math. You can't detect it. But you can do it by knowing it's there in the 34% strong acid, and you know that it's there at 1 or 2%, you can do the math and figure out that it's getting there, but it gets in there at levels that are undetectable even with our most sophisticated levels. And the math says they're 0.1% of what the WHO maximum would be.
Let me add one more comment to that, and that is that Bill brings up a good point. There is, by EPA criteria, a procedure for determining a method precision level and a minimum detectable level. Below, at that point, EPA considers it basically zero. So, like for arsenic as an example, their minimum detection limit by analytical methods that are currently available are about 0.5 of 1 part per billion for arsenic. And anything below that would be considered numerically zero. If you're adding for the one-third, so when they're talking about maximum contaminant goal, that would be close to their zero point as it would be. If you're looking at the amount, if you're looking at one or less than a third of the samples had arsenic at all of the fluoride additives, if you take just those third and you average them and you use the maximum one that was found, you're gonna be considerably below that half a part per billion. So even with the amount of arsenic in the worst case example of the worst sample, you're still going to be considerably below the EPA definition of zero.
Okay.
If that helps you.
If I could follow up.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm slow today, and I apologize for that. I just wanted to trace one of these through so to make sure that I understood it. As I'm looking at these, you said earlier, I believe, that these are the numbers that a manufacturer would use that would be above what they would ever expect to actually produce. So we can reasonably expect that these contaminant levels are too high, based on what the manufacturer at least expects. On the fluorosilicic acid.
Fluorosilicic. It took me several months to be able to wrap my tongue around
AFSA.
That.
AFSA.
Thank you. They show heavy metals, which would include, I presume, all the heavy metals, but they mentioned specifically lead, would be a maximum of 2/100 of 1%, or about 2^-4, I think. 2 × 10^-4, if I've got my arithmetic in my head correct. You're talking about diluting that further by
add five more zeros
by 500
by 500,000
by 500,000
divided by 500,000,
right, which gives you 1 × 10^-8, I think, which just even assuming that every single bit of that contaminant was in fact arsenic, which I take it from what you testified is extremely unlikely, you're still going to be at or below the hoped for level of arsenic, the hoped for maximum future allowance of arsenic of 10 parts per billion.
Oh, yes. Well below that.
Well, actually, if you look at, I've done the math, and I can just tell you that if you take the 1/3 of the samples that have tested positive for arsenic, remember, 2/3 of the samples have not been tested as no measurable arsenic in them. But if you take a look at
before it's diluted,
as delivered by the manufacturer, the material itself.
And excuse me, what level can you actually detect in those kind of samples?
That's pure product sample, so they're measuring more on the order of milligrams per liter, parts per million, not parts per billion.
Okay.
Considerably higher. If you take the samples that do have, and by the way, metals are about only measured in about 10% to 20% of the samples. Arsenic is in about 1/3 of the samples. So there's more arsenic measured than there is metals. But if you look at that and you just take that 1/3 of the samples and you take the worst one, the worst measurement, not the average, but the worst, and you compare it to what it would be diluted in drinking water, it's somewhere about 0.1 to 0.2 parts per billion. And that would be the highest level, because most of the samples wouldn't be that high. But that's what the math works out to, 0.1 to 0.2.
Thank you. It is the cold. I was off by 10. Thanks.
You may be aware
we'll forgive you today.
Fort Collins, Colorado, you know, the same question came up there. They were already fluoridating. They were using the FSA, and the question was raised. And, they cannot detect any difference in any of these things that they don't want. You know, we know we don't like these heavy metals, but by the time it's diluted, they could not be, even looking for them, with the most sensitive equipment, they couldn't detect any difference. That's how much dilution there is there. There's no question that there's some heavy metals in the water everywhere. We just can't detect, whatever we can't detect, we can't detect. We can't know if it's zero, we can't know it's, how many zeros it is before on the sort of right of the decimal point.
And remember, zero for EPA is not absolute true zero. It's what is the reliable level of method of detection, and any way you slice that loaf of bread, we're way below that dilution.
Representative Valco.
Yeah, it occurs to me that, I mean, there might be more heavy metals in the drinking water out of that machine right there than in some water systems. I mean, we don't, I don't think there's any sort of standard for testing bottled water, and so of course you're going to find something. And
bottled water is unregulated in all those health effects.
Right.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I really appreciate your
just what we needed to hear.
Time.
Hey, she wants to drink some of that bottled water.
Unregulated.
I had to work my way through college. I came from a poor family, and one of my jobs was the night sweeper at a factory. And I was told by my supervisor that one of my jobs was to refill the bottle water, and so from a cooler like that. So I had to pull the bottle off each night, take it over to the janitor's mop sink, because that was the only place where I could get it under it, and I'd fill it back up. This is what I was told to do, fill it back up, and then I'd lug it back over and put it on the cooler. And when people would sit there and drink and say, boy, this is so much better than that drinking water, that tap water. If it comes out of a bottle, we presume that it's got to be good.
Got to be good.
Well, we thank you for the opportunity to
really appreciate your
discuss this important topic.
Accommodating us and getting up to Oregon. Very, very kind of you. Thank you, and thank you for the testimony. And at this point, I want to call Don Phillips. Representative Kummel is unable to be with us today, and he has an amendment that his staff is bringing to going to speak for him. And he probably never has been so eloquent as he will be.
You're just saying
I hope
that
he's listening, Valentine's Day.
For the record, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Don Phillips, Chief of Staff for State Representative Jerry Krummel, House District 26. And Representative Krummel does apologize that he could not be here today due to personal reasons. This is a very important issue for Representative Krummel. As a former city councilor and a longtime mayor, local control is one of, I think, very important issues to him and a lot of his constituents. I know that Representative Tomei, as a former mayor, you understand where he's coming from on that. And let me just break down the Dash 1 amendments for you in three areas. First, that is local control. They allow the decision-making process to remain in the hands of local authorities, whether it has a Water District Board of Directors or a City Council or other public body. It also calls for a public hearing or a vote of that public body before the fluoride can be added to the drinking water. In some cases, you'll have an advisory vote of the citizens, and that's still allowed for under this set of amendments. And as we've heard from the League of Cities, from the Central Oregon Cities Organization, and the Special Districts Association, we've heard from their experience that local control really is the best way to go. We looked up from the National Conference of State Legislatures. There are only 12 states that have a state mandate. The rest allow local jurisdictions to make up their own decisions as to what their community wishes to do on the issue of fluoridation in the water. And Representative Krummel's amendments do go a little bit farther than the original bill by allowing jurisdictions with less than 10,000 population to engage in this process and to get involved in help from the state if they choose to go the route of fluoridation. The second component of these amendments is funding. These amendments would allow the Economic and Community Development Department's water fund to provide loans or grants or some other mechanism of funding to help local jurisdictions should they decide they want to use fluoride in the water. That hasn't been hashed out as far as how that's all going to work, but that is a mechanism that is provided for in these amendments. Of course, local communities have other options as far as funding goes. They don't have to use the Economic Development Department's money, or they can use a blend. They can seek private sources. They can seek federal sources. In fact, in Virginia, they used a CDC grant to help some of their local jurisdictions, and there is no state mandate in the state of Virginia. In California, their law actually requires cities and water districts to seek outside funding, not to pass the cost along to their local ratepayers to pay for any kind of program that they might set up. So you are seeing private foundations and some other sources that step forward to help
provide funding in this case. And finally, the third aspect to Representative Crummell's amendments is technical assistance from the Water Resources Department, that local jurisdictions could say, hey, we need some help with some engineering or some design, and we would hope that the Water Resources Department would help them with that. And if there are any questions, I'm available to try and answer them for you.
I have one comment. I think, Don, it strikes me the Water Resource Department is not probably the appropriate agency for this. And as a consequence, if this amendment were to move forward, I think maybe DHS would be a more appropriate agency.
Yeah, we've heard that from other sources as well. We were just trying to figure out which state agency was the right one to provide that technical. We could make that change.
Yeah, that will not present any problem as far as the representative is concerned.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Don, the use of the water fund here, it says using the water fund, is that intended to be a startup cost or an ongoing operating cost?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Brown, like I said, the details haven't been hashed out on how this would work, but under the ORS statute for that water fund, which I brought with me today, it does talk about how the agency can set up their own administrative rules for setting up these programs. So they would be the ones that would make the ultimate decision on that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Don. Let me review the two amendments then that we have there in front of us, dash one and dash two. The dash one amendment, Don, has given you a good overview of. Representative Anderson explained, his ideas, I think, maybe with the dash two amendment, but it's really relatively simple. The thing it does is take out the fiscal and allow provide that cities or water districts only are responsible for doing this if sufficient funds are there to implement the program and the funds not to come from the suppliers. Ratepayers, shareholders, local taxpayers, or bondholders in it, so that there's outside, in essence, outside money for the city to do it. The major distinction between the two issues, the two amendments that you have, I suppose, is the issue of local control. And I know we have a couple of members who our former city mayors, and the issue of local control is always an important issue, but it's also, I think, important to probably note that if any city in the state of Oregon had wanted or had the courage, and probably courage is the better word than wanted, to do this, they could have done it already. They already have the ability to do it. It's not a matter of that they don't have the ability to do it. They're not barred under current statute from doing it. So I'm not going to bring this to a vote today. We do have it scheduled come back to us on Wednesday, and that we'll comply with the 48-hour rule that we have. We've got it in this morning, I think, time to do that.
Yep.
So it will be the first item on our agenda on Wednesday as to whether we bring it to a vote or whether we don't bring it to a vote. So. Or whether we accept one amendment or the other amendment as that. And if there's nothing else for the good of the cause, we were 5 minutes late in getting started, and so we will be 7 minutes early in quitting.